Climate Change the Facts. Cool It, an Essay on Climate Change by Nigel Lawson. Part 1. Nigel Lawson is a former British Conservative politician and journalist, member of the House of Lords, and author of An Appeal to Reason, A Cool Look at Global Warming.
There's something odd about the global warming debate, or the climate change debate, as we are now expected to call it, since global warming has, for the time being, come to a halt. I've never shied away from controversy, nor, for example, as Chancellor, worried about being unpopular if I believed that what I was saying and doing was in the public interest. But I have never in my life experienced the extremes of personal hostility, vituperation, and vilification which I, along with other dissenters, of course, have received for my views on global warming and global warming policies. For example, according to the Climate Change Secretary, Ed Davey, the global warming dissenters are, without exception, quote, willfully ignorant, and in the view of the Prince of Wales, we are, quote, headless chickens. Not that dissenter is a term they use. We are regularly referred to as, quote, climate change deniers, a phrase deliberately designed to echo Holocaust denier, as if questioning present policies and forecasts of the future is equivalent to casting malign doubt about a historical fact. The heir to the throne and the minister are senior public figures who watch their language. The abuse I received after appearing on the BBC's Today program in February 2014 was far less restrained. Both the BBC and I received an orchestrated barrage of complaints to the effect that it was an outrage that I was allowed to discuss the issue on the program at all. And even the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Commons shamefully joined the chorus of those who seek to suppress debate. In fact, despite having written a thoroughly documented book about global warming more than 5 years ago, which happily became something of a bestseller, and having founded a think tank on the subject, the Global Warming Policy Foundation, the following year, and despite frequently being invited on Today to discuss economic issues, this was the first time I had ever been asked to discuss climate change. I strongly suspect it will also be the last time. The BBC received a well-organized deluge of complaints, some of them inevitably, from those with a vested interest in renewable energy, accusing me, among other things, of being a geriatric, retired politician and not a climate scientist, and so wholly unqualified to discuss the issue. Perhaps in passing, I should address the frequent accusation from those who violently object to any challenge to any aspect of the prevailing climate change doctrine that the Global Warming Policy Foundation's non-disclosure of the names of our donors is proof that we are a thoroughly sinister organization and a front for the fossil fuel industry. As I have pointed out on a number of occasions, the Foundation's Board of Trustees decided, from the outset, that it would neither solicit nor accept any money from the energy industry or from anyone with a significant interest in the energy industry. And to those who are not, regrettably, prepared to accept my word, I would point out that among our trustees are a Bishop of the Church of England, a former private secretary to the Queen, and a former head of the civil service. Anyone who imagines that we are all engaged in a conspiracy to lie is clearly in an advanced stage of paranoia. The reason we do not reveal the names of our donors, who are private citizens of a philanthropic disposition, is in fact pretty obvious. Were we to do so, they, too, would be likely to be subject to the vilification and abuse I mentioned earlier, and that is something which, understandably, they can do without. That said, I must admit I am strongly tempted to agree that since I am not a climate scientist, I should from now on remain silent on the subject, on the clear understanding, of course, that everyone else plays by the same rules. No more statements by Ed Davey, or indeed any other politician, including Ed Miliband, Lord Deben, and Al Gore. Nothing more from the Prince of Wales or from Lord Stern. What bliss! But of course this is not going to happen, nor should it, for at bottom this is not a scientific issue. That is to say, the issue is not climate change, but climate change alarmism, and the hugely damaging policies that are advocated, and in some cases put in place in its name. And alarmism is a feature, not of the physical world, which is what climate scientists study, but of human behavior, the province, in other words, of economists, historians, sociologists, psychologists, and, dare I say it, politicians. And en passant, the problem for dissenting politicians, and indeed for dissenting climate scientists for that matter, who certainly exist, is that dissent can be career-threatening. The advantage of being geriatric is that my career is behind me. There is nothing left to threaten. But to return, the climate changes all the time, in different and unpredictable, certainly unpredicted, ways, and indeed often in different ways in different parts of the world. It always has done, and no doubt it always will. The issue is whether that is a cause for alarm, and not just moderate alarm. According to the alarmists, it is the greatest threat facing humankind today, far worse than any of the manifold evils we see around the globe which stem from what Robert Burns called man's inhumanity to man. Climate change alarmism is a belief system and needs to be evaluated as such. There is, indeed, an accepted scientific theory which I do not dispute and which the alarmists claim justifies their belief and their alarm. This is the so-called greenhouse effect, the fact that the Earth's atmosphere contains so-called greenhouse gases, of which water vapor is overwhelmingly the most important, but CO2 is another, which in fact trap some of the heat we receive from the sun and prevent it from bouncing back into space. Without the greenhouse effect, the planet would be so cold as to be uninhabitable. But by burning fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, we are increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and thus, other things being equal, increasing the Earth's temperature. But four questions immediately arise, all of which need to be addressed coolly and rationally. First, other things being equal, how much can increased atmospheric CO2 be expected to warm the Earth? This is known to scientists as climate sensitivity, or sometimes the climate sensitivity of carbon. This is highly uncertain, not least because clouds have an important role to play, and the science of clouds is little understood. Until recently, the majority opinion among climate scientists had been that clouds greatly amplify the basic greenhouse effect, but there is a significant minority, including some of the most eminent climate scientists, who strongly dispute this. Second, are other things equal anyway? We know that over millennia, the temperature of the Earth has varied a great deal, long before the arrival of fossil fuels. To take only the past 1,000 years, 1,000 years ago, we were benefiting from the so-called medieval warm period, when temperatures are thought to have been at least as warm, if not warmer, than they are today. And during the Baroque era, we were grimly suffering the cold of the so-called Little Ice Age, when the Thames frequently froze in winter and substantial ice fairs were held on it, which have been immortalized in contemporary prints. Third, even if the Earth were to warm, so far from this necessarily being a cause for alarm, does it matter? It would, after all, be surprising if the planet were on a happy but precarious temperature knife edge from which any change in either direction would be a major disaster. In fact, we know that, if there were to be any future warming, and for the reasons already given, if is correct, there would be both benefits and what the economists call disbenefits. I shall discuss later where the balance might lie. And fourth, to the extent that there is a problem, what should we calmly and rationally do about it? It is probably best to take the first two questions together. According to the temperature records kept by the UK Met Office, and other series are much the same, over the past 150 years, that is, from the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, mean global temperature has increased by a little under a degree centigrade, according to the Met Office, 0.8 degrees centigrade. This has happened in fits and starts, which are not fully understood. To begin with, to the extent that anyone noticed it, it was seen as a welcome and natural recovery from the rigors of the Little Ice Age. But the great bulk of it, 0.5 degrees Celsius out of the 0.8 degrees Celsius, occurred during the last quarter of the 20th century. It was then that global warming alarmism was born. But since then, and wholly contrary to the expectations of the overwhelming majority of climate scientists, who confidently predicted that global warming would not merely continue but would accelerate, given the unprecedented growth of global carbon dioxide emissions, as China's coal-based economy has grown by leaps and bounds, there has been no further warming at all. To be precise, the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, a deeply flawed body, whose non-scientist chairman is a committed climate alarmist, reckons that global warming has laterally been occurring at the rate of, wait for it, 0.05 degrees Celsius per decade, plus or minus 0.1 degrees Celsius. Their figures, not mine. In other words, the observed rate of warming is less than the margin of error. And that margin of error, it must be said, is implausibly small. After all, calculating mean global temperature from the records of weather stations and maritime observations around the world of varying quality is a pretty heroic task in the first place, not to mention the fact that there is a considerable difference between daytime and nighttime temperatures. In any event, to produce a figure accurate to hundredths of a degree is palpably absurd. The lessons of the unpredicted 15-year global temperature standstill, or hiatus as the IPCC likes to call it, are clear. In the first place, the so-called integrated assessment models, which the climate science community uses to predict the global temperature increase which is likely to occur over the next 100 years, are almost certainly mistaken, in that climate sensitivity is almost certainly significantly less than they once thought, and thus the models exaggerate the likely temperature rise over the next 100 years. But the need for a rethink does not stop there. As the noted climate scientist Professor Judith Curry, chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, recently observed in written testimony to the U.S. Senate, anthropogenic global warming as a proposed theory whose basic mechanism is well understood, but whose magnitude is highly uncertain. The growing evidence that climate models are too sensitive to CO2 has implications for the attribution of late 20th century warming and projections of 21st century climate. If the recent warming hiatus is caused by natural variability, then this raises the question as to what extent the warming between 1975 and 2000 can also be explained by natural climate variability. It is true that most members of the climate science establishment are reluctant to accept this and argue that the missing heat has, for the time being, gone into the very cold ocean depths only to be released later. This is, however, highly conjectural. Assessing the mean global temperature of the ocean depths is, unsurprisingly, even less reliable, by a long way, than the surface temperature record. And in any event, most scientists reckon that it will take thousands of years for this, quote, missing heat to be released to the surface. In short, the CO2 effect on the Earth's temperature is probably less than was previously thought, and other things, that is, natural variability and possibly solar influences, are relatively more significant than has hitherto been assumed. But let us assume that the global temperature hiatus does at some point come to an end, and a modest degree of global warming resumes. How much does this matter? The answer must be that it matters very little. There are plainly both advantages and disadvantages from a warmer temperature, and these will vary from region to region depending to some extent on the existing temperature in the region concerned. And it is helpful in this context that the climate scientists believe that the global warming they expect from increased atmospheric CO2 will be greatest in the cold polar regions and least in the warm tropical regions, and will be greater at night than in the day, and greater in winter than in summer. Be that as it may, studies have clearly shown that overall the warming that the climate models are now predicting for most of this century, I referred to these models earlier and will come back to them later, is likely to do more good than harm. This is particularly true in the case of human health, a rather important dimension of well-being. It is no accident that, if you look at migration for climate reasons in the world today, it is far easier to find those who choose to move to a warmer climate than those who choose to move to a colder climate. And it is well documented that excessive cold causes far more illnesses and deaths around the world than excessive warmth does.
Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.